Tonight, we're going to start another chapter. And of course, remember, this is right after the defeat of Absalom. And it's after Joab killed Absalom and David was mourning the death of his son. This chapter goes into more detail about what was in David's heart at this particular time. In verse 1, we're going to read down through verse 8, it says, "And Joab was told, Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. And so the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, The king is grieving for his son. And the battle stole back into the, and the people stole back into the city that day, as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in a battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son." You can just hear the grieving in his voice here, you know. "Then Joab came to the house to the king and said, Today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives, and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well." I can't help but think, what a thing to say to a man who's grieving over the loss of his son, you know. "Now therefore arise and go out and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night, and that will be worse for you than all the evil that's befallen you from your youth until now. Then the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told the people, saying, There is the king sitting in the gate. And so all the people came before the king, and everyone of Israel had fled to his tent, for everyone had fled to their tent." All right, Diane, would you mind asking the blessing upon this word? Amen. There was an old Scottish preacher named Andrew Bonar, and he is from the 1800s. But he had a saying that he used to say. It was, "Let us be as watchful after the victory as before the battle." So you probably heard the saying, "It's possible to win the battle, but to lose the war." Well, this is kind of what happened to David. Again, after Joab defeated Absalom and his army, you know, David was probably the lowest of lows here from the loss of his son. What should have been a day of celebration to David became a day of mourning and a day of embarrassment and shame, because the army and the people, as they perceived what was happening with the king, and they kind of stole away as though they were ashamed of the fact that Absalom had been killed, back into the city and back into their tents. And it's almost like they had been defeated and humiliated in that defeat. It was very unlike David to be insensitive to the sacrifices of his men, you know, as they served him, and they actually delivered him many times from those who were at war with him. But this day, he was so obsessed with the depth of Absalom that he would think of nothing else. And can you imagine that? I think about, you know, my own son. If something happened to my own son, honestly, I would have tore into Joab for telling me the things that he said. And I would have had nothing else on my mind. But the truth is, Joab did tell him the truth. By isolating himself from his men, he turned a military victory into an emotional defeat. One thing we should remember about David, he was not only a mighty warrior, but he was also an emotional poet and musician. He was a man who could go from the depths of despair to the heights of glory while writing the Psalms. David had already experienced a difficult time after the death of Amnon. You remember what it says in 2 Samuel 13, verse 37 through 39. But Absalom fled and went to Timaleh, the son of Ahimud, king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. Was he speaking about Amnon or Absalom? Well, I think he was speaking about Amnon. And so Absalom fled and went to Geshur, and he was there 3 years. And King David longed to go to Absalom, but even though he was mourning for Amnon, he also, I believe, was mourning from the loss of his son Amnon from his fellowship with him. For he had been comforted concerning Amnon because he was dead. In other words, he arrived at that place where he was no longer inconsolable. But this was the death of his favorite son. Absalom was his favorite son, and it left him inconsolable. You know, it was hard for the people to see the love this father had for Absalom. They saw him as this Absalom as a liar and as a murderer, as a traitor, and as a rebel. And they saw what the law had to say about such people. Under the law, a rebellious son like this was to be stoned to death. And I don't believe the mother and father were to pity them. In Deuteronomy 21, verse 18 through 23, it says, if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey the voice of his father and the voice of his mother, and who, when they have chastened him, will not heed them, then the father and his mother shall take hold of him and bring him out to the elders of his city, to the gate of the city. Again, that's to court. And they shall say to the elders of this city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of the city shall stone him to death with stones. So you shall put away the evil from among you, and all Israel shall hear and fear. I honestly believe that the people did hear, and they believed that word. And yet here is David, you know, who is mourning over the death of a rebellious son. Now, certainly we expect a father to grieve over a tragic death of a son and to overlook the son's mistakes and sins. But leaders must still lead, even if their hearts are broken. That's one of the prices that a true leader must pay. On October the 10th, 1950, Sir Winston Churchill was introduced at the University of Copenhagen as the architect of victory in World War II. Churchill replied, I was only the servant of my country, and had I at any moment failed to express her unflinching resolve to fight and conquer, I should have at once have been rightly cast aside. You see, a leader has to lead no matter what the cost. David, as the father, forgot that he was also David, the king, and that he still had his crown. And he had that crown because of the work of his brave soldiers. And he needed to put the good of the nation ahead of his own personal interests. That's a hard thing to do, and it's a high calling. Joab's short, cutting speech to David kind of jolted David back to reality, I think. David took his place at the gate, again, where he would judge and where he would acknowledge the men's brave service, and that did a lot to bring back his kingdom to him. Verse 9 through 15, it says, now all the people were in dispute throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, the king saved us from the hand of his enemies, he delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled from that land because of Absalom. But Absalom, who we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king? And so King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house, since the words of all Israel have come to the king, to his very house? You are my brethren, you are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, you are my bone and my flesh. God, do so to me and more also, if you are not commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. And so he swayed the hearts of the men of Judah and the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king, return, you and all your servants. And the king returned and came to Jordan, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. Now, I think it's obvious, too, that David did not yet know that it was Joab that had killed his son Absalom. Otherwise, he might have responded differently when he first came to him there. But it didn't take long for David to probably find out that Joab and his men are the ones who killed his son. And I think that may be the very thing that precipitated David in naming Amasa the general of his army. Now, Amasa was one of David's nephews who Absalom had named as the general of his army. And so it was kind of ingenious that he not only spoke to the tribe elders of Judah, but also singled out Amasa, and by, again, speaking to the elders and speaking to Amasa and telling Amasa what he was willing to do, that's what would lead Judah and their influence over the other tribes to bring the king back to Jerusalem. Because Judah was the biggest tribe, after all, and it was David's tribe. Before David's death, he gave Solomon specific instructions concerning Joab. And I think that David probably didn't kill him himself immediately because he was a relative. In 2 Kings 2, 5 through 6, it says, "Moreover, you know also that Job, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, and that he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel, to Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether, whom he killed, and he shed the blood of war in peacetime, and put the blood of war on his belt, and was around his waist, and his sandals that were on his feet. Therefore, do according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace." Now, he didn't mention anything about Absalom. However, I believe he probably suspected, and so that may be why David made this decision. When he finally arrived in Jerusalem, it was a signal to the nation that the rebellion was ended and that the true king was back on the throne. But en route to Jerusalem, David made some royal decisions that sent out another important message to the people, and that was the fact that he wanted his kingdom to be a united kingdom. A united people, the old prejudices and the animosities had to be buried, and the nation must be united behind its king. Within the tribes, the people were divided between followers of Absalom and followers of David. And again, there was an old division between the 10 tribes and the division between them and Judah that still persisted. And as we go on, as we study the next couple of books, we see that eventually that there would be a split in the nations, and they would become the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel, which would be the 10 tribes. The leaders of all 12 tribes should have united in sending an informal invitation to David to return to reign, but tribal friction kept that from happening. And David knew that the trouble would only increase if he waited too long to regain the city and the throne. So he went to the tribe of Judah first. Judah was his own royal tribe. His capital city was in Judah. It was the elders of Judah that first made him king in the first place. And so he logically turned to them first. David used his two priests as intermediators who told the elders of Judah that the Israelites and the other tribes were talking about returning the king to Jerusalem. But he had not heard anything about his own tribe. Why were they dragging their feet? And Absalom had begun his rebellion in Hebron, which is in Judah, and the leaders of Judah must have cooperated with him, so it was time that they displayed their allegiance to David, the rightful king. And maybe it was because of that allegiance to Absalom that they hesitated in bringing David back. It's likely that all the tribal leaders who had foolishly followed Absalom were wondering, what would David do to us once he regained the throne? Because after all, they had betrayed him. The news that David was appointing Amasa must have shocked the leaders of the nation since Absalom made him the general, but at the same time, it probably brought a great deal of relief to them because it meant that David was pardoning all the officials, at least with Amasa, and he was going to be the general over David's army. And he was, in fact, a nephew to David, and he was a cousin to Joab. So no doubt David found out that Joab, he killed Absalom. And if he could do this to his son, then he might do this to the king himself. And that's maybe why he changed the guard, so to speak. He had defied the order from the king not to kill Absalom, at least Joab did, and he did not have authority to act as judge and executioner. Joab had been gradually increasing his authority and as becoming more and more powerful, and perhaps David saw that as a threat. In the ancient Middle East, the king was the commander-in-chief of the army, but if a king appointed someone to take his place, for whatever reason, he became a man of high esteem and authority. And that's what Joab was, you know. He's the one who told David to come to Rabbah for the final conquest. Otherwise, Joab would have taken the city and probably named it for himself and after himself. And by the time the Battle of the Forest of Ephraim was over, where Absalom was killed, Joab had at least 10 armor bearers. He had quite a following behind him. Joab also had a record of eliminating anybody who threatened his authority. He and his brother Abishai killed Abner, who had been King Saul's general. Before the story ends, he would kill Amasa as well. Now, I want to look ahead and see what happened to cause this to happen. Now, remember, David appointed Amasa in place of Joab. And the king said to Amasa, "Assemble the men of Judah for me within 3 days, to be present here and be present here yourself." This is 2 Samuel 20, verse 4 through 13. And so Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba the son of Berechi will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servant and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape us." So Joab's men with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and the mighty men went out after him, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Berechi, when they were at the large stone, which is in Gibbon. Amasa came before them. Now Joab was dressed in battle armor, and on his belt was a sword was fastened in its sheath at his hip. And he was going forward. When he was going forward, it fell out. Then Joab said to Amasa, "Are you in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard and with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not notice that the sword was in Joab's hand. And he struck him in the stomach, and his entrails poured out on the ground, and he did not strike him again. Thus he died. Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Berechi. Meanwhile, one of Job's men stood near Amasa and said, "Whoever favors Job and whoever is for David, follow Job." But Amasa wallowed in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he moved Amasa from the highway and the freeway, and the highway and the field, and threw a garment over him when he saw that everyone who came upon him had halted. And when he had removed when he was removed from the highway, all the people went after Job to pursue Sheba, the son of Berechi. So, pretty harsh. Now, truth is, Job and his brother caused much grief to David in the early stages of his reign. And, of course, Job knew all about Uriah and probably was, you know, that's probably a piece of information that carried more power than the sword did when it came to what he held over David. But when he killed Absalom, that was the last straw. So David saw this as an opportunity to get rid of his power-hungry general. And by appointing Amasa, David quickly united the army and declared amnesty on all the rebel soldiers, giving them a new beginning. As we look at verse 16 through 23 of chapter 19, and Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was in Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. And they went over to the Jordan before the king, and the ferry boat went across to care over the king's household to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he crossed the Jordan. And he said to the king, "Do not let the Lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart." Kind of like he's saying, "I was only joking, you know. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king." But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, "Shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed?" And David said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? That you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel?" Therefore the king said to Shimei, "You shall not die." And the king swore to him. Not only the men of Judah came to meet David at the Jordan and to welcome him, but his enemy Shimei, the Benjamite, with about 1,000 men from his tribe. Well, Ziba, the land manager for Mephibosheth, was also there with his 15 sons and 20 servants. Somebody provided a ferry boat to go back and forth to Jordan to carry the king's household and to ford them across the river, so they wouldn't have to ford across the river. And when David arrived on the western bank of the river, again, this Shimei prostrated himself and begged for mercy. There's no doubt that Shimei deserved to be killed for the way he treated David. Abishai was willing to do the job, but again, David stopped him. Again, the first time he stopped Abishai from, taking his life. Remember, he said, "Let me go over there and dispatch this guy. Basically, let me go take off his head." But Abishai felt that the second time he needed to be killed because he had cursed the king. And David felt like, no, this is a day of rejoicing. It's not a day of revenge. But also, by pardoning Shimei, King David was offering pardon and general amnesty to all who had supported Absalom during the rebellion. David kept his word and did not have Shimei killed for his crime. But when David was about to die, he told Solomon to keep an eye on Shimei. Solomon put him under the house arrest, and he told him not to leave Jerusalem. He told him that if he left Jerusalem, again, he would be executed. And that's exactly what happened. Shimei had a weakness for resisting authority and treating God's ministers with disdain, and that's why David cautioned Solomon. Shimei didn't appreciate David's mercy or Solomon's grace, and his independence and his arrogance finally caught up with him. There's a lesson in that for us today as we read the book of Jude. It tells us that there are people within the church, and he's talking about people in the church. "Likewise, also, these dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, speak evil of dignitaries. Yet Michael the archangel, in contending with the devil, when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.' But these speak evil of what they do not know, and what have they known naturally, like brute beasts in the things that they corrupt themselves. Woe to them, for they have gone the way of Cain. They have run greedily in the air of Balaam for profit and perished in the rebellion of Korah." Now remember the rebellion of Korah? Korah said, why does Moses get to judge everything? We should be able to do that too, and trying to usurp that authority that Moses had. But the Lord says, "These are spots in your love feasts, while they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves. They are clouds without water, carried about by the winds, late autumn trees without fruit, twice dead, pulled up by the roots, raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackest of darkness forever." Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men, also saying, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints to execute judgment on all and to convict all who were ungodly among them, notice the word among them, of all their ungodly deeds, which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. These are grumblers, complainers, walking according to their own lusts, and they mouth great swelling words, flattering people to gain advantage. But you, beloved, remember the words which were spoken by the apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ, how they told you that there would be mockers in the last times who would walk according to their own ungodly lusts. These are sensual persons who cause divisions, not having the Spirit. Unfortunately, in churches, there are those who will, for some reason or another, get disgruntled with the leadership in the church. And no sooner are they out the door, they'll get on the telephone, or they'll start saying bad things about the pastor or somebody in leadership, like at lunch or something like that. And then it just kind of spreads like wildfire. And this is what the Lord's talking about, you know. Why is this such a serious thing with God? One of the things that God hates is those who sow discord among the brethren. And the scripture tells us very clearly, it says, you know, as believers, it says that we should, again, obey those who have rule over us as those who must give an account for your soul, and let them do so with joy and not with grief. You know, the old saying, we have too many chiefs in this church and not enough Indians. I know that's probably not politically correct today, but it serves a point. It is true in a lot of churches. A lot of times people don't want to submit to the authority of the Word of God, and they all have their idea of how things should be run. But God has placed a shepherd within a church for the purpose of leading the church. And he is the one that's responsibility of how that church turns out. And so the best thing a believer can do is pray for him. Now, if he's in open sin, again, that of course has to be dealt with the elders. But just because, like say, the pastor, for example, likes the heater on 70 degrees and you prefer it at 65, that's not a reason for contention. You know, and so many times people get upset about the silliest things. And this is a warning about that. Make sure that you don't go and talk badly about those who are in authority. Any thoughts or questions before I move on here? All right, verse 24 through 30, and with this we'll close. Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day that the king departed until the day he returned in peace. And so it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? And he answered, My lord, O king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before the Lord, my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those to eat at your table. Therefore, what right have I to cry out any more to the king? And so the king said to him, Why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, You and Ziba divide the land. Then Mephibosheth said to the king, Rather, let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. Again, Ziba shows up to help David as he was fleeing Jerusalem from Absalom, and he told David that Mephibosheth was hoping that David would be defeated so that Saul's lands would become all of his. And of course he lied, and he wanted control of everything. David impulsively made the decision to turn Mephibosheth's land over to Ziba. It couldn't have been easy for Mephibosheth to travel to Jordan to meet David, but But he wanted the opportunity to set the story straight and to expose Ziba's lies and to affirm his allegiance to David, because he was truly loyal to the king. In coming to the king, he was making it clear that he wasn't asking for anything here. The king had given him a life, and so that was more than what he desired. And to paraphrase the speech, he said, "I have more than I deserve, so why should I ask for the throne? I was destined to die, and you not only saved me, but you took me into your own family circle." Now, taking away half of Mephibosheth's inheritance hardly seems, you know, a fit thing to do, especially in what was supposed to be a joyful moment in a forgiving atmosphere of that day. And yet, by dividing the estate, David was also forcing Ziba to come tell the truth, but also he was also forgiving him as well of the treachery to his master. But David also may have made it, you know, an easy way out for him. But Mephibosheth, his reply must have stunned David. Remember in verse 30, he said, "Then Mephibosheth said to the king, 'Rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house.'" Again, this situation here should remind us of the case of the dead baby that Solomon dealt with. And remember that one of the ladies, the two ladies had babies, one of them laid with her baby and rolled over on it and it died. And she took the other baby and they brought it before the king, and they each claimed the baby. And King Solomon said, "Bring me a sword." He was going to cut the baby in two. And the woman, whose baby it was, said, "No, Lord, let her have it, let her." The other one said, "No, go ahead, cut it in half." Well, obviously, the woman who said, "No, don't do it," was the mother. And so he used some wisdom. I think maybe the point here is that maybe David was testing Mephibosheth also to see where his heart was. No matter what, Mephibosheth, the lame prince, was cared for by the king. And as for Ziba, you know, he still had to work the land, you know. And who knows what David had come up with as far as, you know, judgment, as far as lying to him. Maybe we'll look into that more as we go on in this study. But I just thought it was kind of interesting that, because a lot of times we look at, well, David wasn't very just here. Like I said, maybe he was applying that same principle that Solomon was, because he wanted to see what Mephibosheth's heart was. And Mephibosheth made it clear what his heart was. Any thoughts or questions?
You're not lowering the thermostat in 65, are you?